What is that
song? They smoke a Juul.
What was that?
What was the sound? Yeet?
What is that? I don't even know. And
it's just a thing that the kids say.
It's a thing that kids say when they like do something, like kick something. They're like, yeet. I don't know. Don't put this in because I don't want people to know how old and just detached I am.
And welcome to State of the Revolution. I'm Liano Sheeran. I'm joined by our friends Ellie Gonzalez and Jeremy Alexander. This is our last show of the year. We're recording on December 28th, 2018, as we head into the new year. So we want to talk a little bit about the year in review, things that are going on important right now, and then talk a little bit about what we think is going to go on in 2019. I want to start out today talking about the Green New Deal, because there's been a lot of talk about it, but I just want to break it down into really clear structural terms about what's really going on here. What's really happened here is that millennials, progressives, people who care about the future of our families and our loved ones and the planet got together. We had a really good day at the polls in November. We got a lot of new people elected to the House. We showed a lot of strength across a lot of other races, and we showed up to Nancy Pelosi's office, spearheaded by the Sunrise Movement, and we said, we need a plan. And what we just found out that Pelosi and the Democratic caucus in the House have said is, nah, we don't really want to have a plan. Okay, let's be clear about this. I want to make a really stark comparison. What we're talking about here is that there are a lot of very wealthy and powerful people who on paper have trillions of dollars of assets on paper in their stock portfolios, in their corporate valuations for Exxon and Shell and all of these other corporations. And that is based on a whole bunch of carbon that's in the ground. And if that carbon cannot be brought up out of the ground and burned, then they don't have those trillions of dollars. And it has no benefit to them. And the fight that we're in right now is, are they going to be able to burn that carbon and have those trillions of dollars? Or are we going to say, no, you can't do that, because burning that carbon to make those trillions of dollars for you few already very wealthy and powerful people to do that is a tremendous devastation to the planet. It will cause tremendous pain, suffering, and death across millions and tens of millions and hundreds of millions of people all across the world. And what the progressive movement and the left and a lot of centrists and a lot of establishment, even Democrats, stood up and said was, we ought to have a plan. And this is supported, let me just point out, this is supported, according to recent polling, by 92% of Democrats, 88% of independents, and 64% of Republicans, including 57% of conservative Republicans. They support the Green New Deal. Okay. And what the Democratic leadership in the House has said, led by Pelosi, is we don't want to have a plan. Who is it among their constituents that don't want a plan?
Right.
It's the people that have that carbon in the ground and those trillions in their, in their portfolios that's representing that. And they want to keep having that. And I want to break this down a little bit more. The point is that there are certain things that when you own them, just the fact of owning them and wanting to extract wealth from them is toxic, whether that's burning coal or fossil fuels of any kind right now in the current state of our environment, or whether it was 1860 and we're talking about owning people is a toxic social environment. It's terrible for the people. It's unconscionable to allow people to own other people. In our current context, it's unconscionable to let people own this carbon in the ground. The only thing they can do with it is hurt other people. So we're at this point again where we have a group of a small group of very, very wealthy people who want to lay claim to ownership in a way that is toxic just by owning it. And that's what we're confronted with right now. We're confronted with that same kind of structure, and we need to think about what it means that the establishment Democrats in the House don't even want to have a plan.
Yeah, and I think that mostly it's always going to just come back to money. And it's not just the few who own the carbon. It's not just the few who have these like trillions in assets like that you had said. But obviously there are vested interests that Nancy Pelosi has as well, which is why she wants to do that. And there's a lot of Congress people who are supposed to be representing us, but who don't represent the majority, who are representing those like lobbyists, the lobbyist groups who also have vested interests in their pockets in this. But it's important to know that these people are going to be okay in 12 years if the worst case scenario happens. They are going to have the resources to continue living, for their families to continue living mostly normal lives. So I guess, yeah, the big problem is where do we go from here? How exactly are we supposed to convince Nancy Pelosi, who should already be convinced,
right,
that it's a more serious problem than she's making it?
I'm not sure that's possible. I mean, I think that we have to, that one of the things that we have to confront is the possibility that it's not about convincing people like Pelosi. I mean, let's be honest. The science is not in dispute.
Right.
At least it's not in dispute by anybody who isn't being paid handsomely by special interests who want to have that carbon come up because that's how they're going to make their money. There are no independent reputable scientists. I don't even know there are any independent disreputable scientists. There's the only scientists I know of that argue the other side are literally being paid by the fossil fuel industry or their lackeys. Yeah. So the scientific evidence is there. If we're not going to base our decisions of our government on the evidence that we have, okay, that this is a real climate catastrophe right now, and that it's going to get worse, and that we have an option. We can either continue the way that we're going and let the next 12 years, as the recent report said, roll by without making any changes, and we're going to get even worse, or we could do some really important stuff over the next 12 years and mitigate some of that. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that it's not, at this point, I don't know that it's a question of convincing Nancy Pelosi or convincing any of the other establishment Democrats. The evidence is there, okay? Either they don't believe the science, okay, in which case they have no business being in government any more than a bunch of these Republicans have,
right?
Okay, or they're bought off by the special interests in the fossil fuel industry,
right?
Okay, and if you understand the science, the decision that they made is just unconscionable.
Mm-hmm.
It's just unconscionable. It's saying we're not going to make a plan to mitigate a disaster we know is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's just irresponsible. I would argue as irresponsible as anything that Republicans are doing right now. Do you think they can be convinced? I mean, tell me what gives you a reason to think that we can convince Pelosi or the other establishment leaders of the party?
I don't know.
I mean, honestly, personally, I have no idea how she keeps getting.
I don't understand how anyone can put profit over the life of our planet and the people on this planet. I don't know how somebody can be a Democrat and somehow benefit from. I don't understand what she's really getting out of it aside from lining her pockets. I mean, I it doesn't make any sense. If conservative Republicans, a large majority of them, see the science and know what's going on and want positive change and want a plan, I don't understand how the hell she how she can't. I don't know.
Let me just say, by the way, I'm not even necessarily convinced that it's because she's lining her pockets. Okay. Mm. I'm not even necessarily convinced it's that she wants a good payday. I'm not saying that. That might be the case, but I have no problem believing that this is just a case of, she looks at it and says, well, you know, my donors are going to help me get reelected. I'm not necessarily sure. Trying to line her pockets, but my donors are going to help me get reelected. They're going to help me reelect a bunch of other Democrats. We'll do what we have to do to make that happen. And the problem with that is we don't have the time. No. Again, right. Either you believe the science or you don't. Mm-hmm. And if you don't believe the science, you're just not being rational because the evidence is there. It's not controversial.
Yeah, and I think that the interesting thing about the this whole topic of like global warming and where the issue is coming from are carbon emissions and things like that. You usually see a lot of people talking about the ethics of it, not from the global warming aspect, but for the economic prosperity for the people who live mm-hmm. in these Appalachian regions. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that it's Nancy Pelosi who is being kind of just like obstinate about this, because it's something you would expect more from like someone in Pennsylvania or Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia, these Appalachian like areas where the people do grow up right. to go underground to make these livings for their families.
But not somebody whose whole fucking state is on fire because of climate change or yes. really like. Yeah.
Well, so I want to point out it's not just Appalachian areas where there's a lot of coal. You've got fracking going on all over mm-hmm. the country.
Yeah.
You've got oil extraction out of the Canadian tar sands that they want to pump through pipes going through Michigan.
Yeah.
That we already know leak. I also want to emphasize that this is. That they've got the people that you're talking about, people from Appalachian, people from oil producing states, and people that are getting a lot of money from fracking companies and so on. These are the people in the other committees that are complaining that, hey, if you make this New Deal committee, this New Deal Select Committee, and you give them subpoena power or legislative power, then they're like, they're treading on my turf. That's what a lot of these Congress people who taking a lot of fossil fuel money, not all of them, but a lot of them, are saying. And that's one of the excuses that they're using. Okay. And then you have Kathy Castor, who Nancy appointed, or I guess they're talking about that she's going to be the chair of this climate change panel that they've had before and didn't come up with a plan.
Yep.
And right now their plan is it's not clear if they're actually going to fund it enough that they can actually do much of the research that needs to be done to figure out what the plan could be or what the plan ought to be. It's not clear that they're going to get the funding. It's not clear that they're going to get subpoena power. And it's almost certain that they're not going to get the power to write legislation. And if you can't do all of that, what you're saying is, you're saying that you don't expect this committee to actually produce a plan.
Yeah, but it's just placating.
Right.
It's just placating us.
Right. And if I was a congressperson being assigned to that committee, I'd be looking at it and going, are you wasting my time? Because without those capabilities, you're basically saying we're gonna have this really kind of broad ad hoc or to kind of throw stuff at the wall and see what works approach to solving a significant global crisis. And that's just that's just irresponsible. We have to really start thinking about government as the process by which large groups of people make decisions together. And if our government is not able to make good decisions, then we need to really look at how that government is structured.
Yeah.
And a lot of different ways, there's campaign finance reform, of course, which is a big part of this because of the money in the fossil fuel industry. But there's lots of other things like the structure of the Senate, which is, Which is something that we want to get into. Actually, I want to tie that into. I wanted to also talk about the lame duck session here in Michigan and in Wisconsin and to a certain extent in North Carolina. Do you guys know a lot about the stuff that's been going on?
A little.
Yeah, a little.
Okay. So I just to break it down, what it comes down to is that the Michigan State Legislature, this is also true in Wisconsin, it's also true in North Carolina, but let's talk about Michigan. The Michigan State Legislature is controlled by Republicans because of the gerrymandering that they did in 2010. Since 2010, I believe they've lost the popular vote in both of those, in both of the houses of the Michigan State Legislature, 2 out of 3 times, and the third time they won it by like 3,000 votes across, millions of votes cast. This past election, this midterm, they lost by something like 5 points in both houses. Which is tens of thousands. It's over 100,000 votes in each house that they lost by. And what they've done is they pass in the lame duck session after they can no longer be held accountable by the voters. They passed over 400 pieces of legislation just in like a couple of weeks. Previous to that, they had over the whole 2 years of the session, they had only passed 300 something. Mm-hmm. Okay. And in addition to this, what they're doing is there is a lot of their stuff is overturning the will of the voters, either restricting the powers of the governor or the attorney general or secretary of state that the voters elected to serve the roles as they're currently constituted. And then the other thing that they're doing is they're going after actual voter initiatives that passed by huge margins. We've reported on the show before, all of those initiatives, each of them passed by a larger margin than any candidate won by across the state. Okay. Very often you have Republican districts gerrymandered to be Republican districts who, because they're gerrymandered, they retained their seat, but those propositions still did better than they did in their own districts, but they're voting against it. Okay. And everybody in, we've got tons of people in Michigan that are really up in arms about all of this stuff going on in the state legislature, where you have a legislature elected by a minority dictating what the majority should be able to do, which is completely undemocratic. But the point that I want to make to tie this in is that this is exactly how the U.S. Senate works all the time. 17% of the population elects 52 senators. So everything that everybody in Michigan is on about what's going on with the Michigan legislature in the lame duck session, that's exactly what happens in the U.S. federal Senate every single day. And, we need to start making these connections about how our government works, both locally, state, nationally, to prevent the will of the people from driving the direction of public policy.
Yeah.
Do you guys any thoughts on how we get that message across to people?
It's hard to, because as you said, there's no longer any accountability. So especially speaking when you're talking about the lame duck in Michigan, there's nothing else that we can do. These legislators are on their way out of the door. Mm-hmm. This is their one last ditch effort to undermine not just the newcomers, Dana Nessel and Gretchen Whitmer and anyone else, but just to undermine everyone else, to undermine their constituents.
Right, right.
And these are people who obviously are, I don't see how they could go back into politics. These have to be people who are safe from the voters at this point, because I don't know how they could come back from something like this, doing something to infuriate their constituents in this way. So I don't know. I don't know what what the solution is. And I don't know how, when our new legislators come in, how we can even overturn that. I'm not sure how.
Yeah. And what do we do? It's almost like they're walking out of the house after they burned it down.
Yeah.
And there's just
and they took the fire extinguishers or something. I don't know.
Have fun. Good luck. Good luck, Gretchen,
it's just a way that they can almost prove, 2 years, 4 years down the line, look at how horrible she did.
Right, look at how terrible things are now.
You guys voted, and look at nothing that you guys voted for is happening.
The odds against
mm-hmm.
the, yeah.
It's, I think it's a hard question, but it's something that we've got to confront, because if we're going to deal with the problems that we have lots of really big problems,
yeah,
all over the world and certainly in our country, in the state here. And if we're going to solve them, we have to have good ways of working together to find out what the real viable solutions are. And those real viable solutions are about how we address issues of life and death for people. And we can't put somebody's profit margin ahead of somebody's life. That's just not, and that's what we've consistently done under our current system. And until we get a handle on our government and have people and elect people that aren't willing to do that, that are not willing to put profit before people, we're going to keep having these kinds of problems. We're going to keep having situations like the two young children that died.
Yeah.
Was it ICE custody at the border? No, it was the U.S. government. I wasn't sure if it was ICE specifically.
But well, I think it's hard because, and I don't know if it's the school specifically or if it's just the general attitude of a lot of people who have had children, is so many people think that their humanity is less important than following the law. So, These children have died, and people are still, they're still opposing talking points. Well, they broke the law, and if they had stayed in their country, they'd still be alive. You've seen it with the anti-fascist protests in DC. People were like so shocked, and they abhorred that these like people had broken the windows at Starbucks, right. And now look where we're at 2 years later. There's children dying, and people
and
are still
camps.
Yep.
Right.
They're still more concerned with following the laws, mm-hmm. and with capital and mm-hmm. with property than they are with humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to teach children, and we have to teach people to unlearn that, mm-hmm. prioritizing that there are things that are more important maybe than all of us individually, but that's just all of us together. It's right. never going to be corporations.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the law of the land. So we have to start there. It's just all going to be a learning process.
Yeah. And it's really a process of cultural change. We have to look at how our culture works and be clear about that. And it's really hard to do. I've spent a lot of time overseas, and I do and engaging with other cultures, and I do cross-cultural training to help people learn how to observe their own culture from the sidelines, so to speak, so
right.
that you can look at it. To the extent that you can look at anything objectively. And really what it's about is looking at the structures, which is why I started out talking about the structure of the conflict that led to the Civil War was a question about whether it's okay to own people or not.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided that it was not okay to own people.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided that because this was a terrible thing for us to do, for any society to do. And the complaint was you're depriving people of their property. Well, first of all, what we're saying is that's not an acceptable use of the term property.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
And the structure today is exactly the same in the sense that we have people that are claiming ownership of something and claiming the right to use that however they want without regard to how it affects everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1860, they were talking about without regard to how it affects slaves.
Yeah.
I would argue also with how it affects the whole society, where you have that kind of oppression as an institutionalized feature of the society. That's just toxic to everything. Now we're talking about literally poisoning the planet to the extent that it's going to reduce the areas of the earth and the areas of the earth that are suitable for human habitation.
Yeah.
And potentially much reduce them. you know, and it's, you know, and poison people along the way. You know, it's, I keep repeating this, but it's like people are so inured to it because it's been going on for so long, mm-hmm. and they're so used to, well, that's the way things are, and people are so used to, well, those are the people in charge and they'll figure it out. But at some point, we have to be able to wake up and say, hey, if we actually believe in democracy, the first part of that is demos, and that means that people have to be involved.
Yeah.
And we have to create a situation where more people can be more involved. And part of that, I think, is opening up the discussion in a number of ways. Number one, we have to have areas where we can talk about things where people aren't afraid that if they get it wrong, they're going to be attacked because they're going to be personally attacked. Mm. We need to be able to have areas of where we need to be able to have areas where people can come out and say what they're thinking and what they're feeling, and have those ideas responded to, and learn not to take that somebody's criticizing their thoughts and ideas. Don't take it as a personal attack. Let's talk about the thoughts and ideas. And it's okay to be wrong.
Yeah, that's the hard part, is convincing people that they are allowed to be wrong. It's just what they do when they realize that it's going to be difficult. People are very touchy. Mm-hmm. And we're finally to a point now where smart people are the people that they want to listen to, not vapid people, not people with these very shallow, like, talking points. So, you know, anyone who's perceived as stupid, it's actually not a flattering thing. You know, we're not in that headspace anymore where that celebrity ignorance is very cool. Now you have to be smart to be taken serious, and when you're not smart, you're not.
Well, on the other hand, there's about 30% of the country that supports Trump, and the man is not a smart man. I'm sorry. He has certain instincts. I don't deny that he has certain instincts, but he's certainly not a good businessman, no. And he's certainly not an intelligent man in terms of how the world actually works and how policy works and how the government works or how any of that. This is not, you know, and that's no disparagement. I'm not trying to be disparaging. I'm just talking about these are the facts. Okay.
I'm trying to be disparaging, and honestly, I don't get how even 30% right. of the United States can be swayed by him. He doesn't have like a cult of personality. He's not a very intriguing speaker. Like, you know, when you talk about Francisco Franco or Benito Mussolini, these people had charisma mm-hmm. and intelligence and militaristic backgrounds where mm-hmm. they were like, we can rise up and we can ignite this, you know, fan base and the support mm-hmm. in our countries. And it just shocks me that Trump has been able to do that United States with none of the charisma. And right. that's not to, I feel like I say this and it makes it sound like I'm like
a fan
praising them. Like, yeah.
Mussolini,
but,
no.
But it gave right. the reason why it happened, and Trump has none of that. He has lacked all of it, and so it just really confuses him.
Yeah. See, I think that's the wrong analysis. I don't think that it's about charisma. I mean, I think that those people, I agree with you that those people had charisma, however despicable their ideas. But it was also, it's also a question of what is happening in the culture at the moment and what people are thinking and feeling. And the fact of the matter is that it's a lot easier to blame somebody else than right. to mm-hmm. engage in self-reflection.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is that, I mean, for, you know, the whole time that I've been politically aware since the 80s, you know, when I was, you know, in grade school and middle school, because I was an, you know, early political addict, but the way that people react to the environment around them isn't necessarily about a rational engagement with the ideas that the politicians are talking about. It's very often a reaction to, this is my current situation, and I'm not, you know, I have this option. I can either listen to the people who are saying there's a real problem, we have to do a lot of work to solve it, mm-hmm. or I can talk to the person that says, hey, these people who I've told you for decades not to like, these people who I've told you for decades not to like, and not only me, but lots of other people like me, particularly on the Republican side, but not exclusively, have told you not to like these people, it's their fault. Okay.
Yeah.
That's just an easier, that just requires less emotional labor. Speaking as a cisgendered straight white guy, I'll tell you, there's an awful lot of cisgendered straight white people, rich and poor alike, who don't get that privilege isn't their fault, despite the fact that they have right. it.
Yeah.
And don't see a, look at the two situations and say, hey, I it's much easier to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And without that, without any kind of self-reflection, it's just, there's going to be a group of, 25 to 35% of the population that is going to take a while before, really they get to the point where they can acknowledge, okay, I have this kind of privilege and I didn't ask for it, but that's the fact. And
how can I use this?
Well, it's not even a question of how can I use this. It's a question of, given that there is a disparity, across our country, that's creating a bunch of problems, how can we change how we organize so that everybody has what they need without having to have some people privileged and other people disadvantaged?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean equality of outcomes, by the way. That's a completely red herring that you get from the right wing. We can talk about that in a bit if you want. I want to move on to the next topic. Allie, you wanted to talk about new charges relating to the Nassar case that came up recently?
Last month in November, Luana K. Simon had been charged with two misdemeanor counts and two felony counts of lying and misleading statements that she had given to the police as far as what her involvement was and what her knowledge was. The extent of these charges in this title suit against Larry Nassar and Michigan State University. And I wanted to kind of just like talk about that and the parallel between what she actually did and as far as with Larry Nassar and how she had attacked, I think it was Penn State during the Jerry Sandusky trial when she was on the, she was on the board for the NCAA chastising Penn State, and it was happening within her own campus, and kind of just like the hypocrisy of that. And, we're in Michigan. This has been big news all year.
Yeah.
All year. It has dominated the news cycle, not only, with our local news cycles, but nationally. I mean, this made national news. Mm-hmm. I mean, Judge Rosemary Aquilina was... that she got her little, bit of like quasi fame basically off of this, where she allowed the 150 victims to come up and speak. And, within hours of them going up to speak, Luana K. Simon stepped down from Michigan State University as the president. She no longer is the president.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it is very pervasive thing that's happening because with, now that Larry Nassar has fallen, we're starting to see that it's happening in a lot of other universities. I think it's Ohio State was another one. Mm-hmm. They're finally starting to do these investigations into these doctors. And it's kind of just like, we've been saying, millennials, the women who have come before us, there is a rape culture in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Luana K. Simon going down basically with the ship, really just highlights that rape culture is not only perpetuated by men, that it is being perpetuated by the people in power, and that includes women. So I just thought that it was very interesting that she actually had, there were consequences to the actions that she did. She did despicable things. She knew about it. she lied about it. They're trying to make it seem like she's being crucified or vilified, and it's not the case. And I think that it's very amazing that she's being held accountable for her part in this.
So one of the things I wanted to say about that is that notice that you started out telling the story, and it was when all of these people, 150 people, came up and spoke about what was going on. So what we're really seeing, and this is something that's going to happen, I think, more and more, is the emergence of a much more open culture about things that really happen.
Mm-hmm.
You can and that's something that we're going to see a lot more stuff with. I think one of the places you can see sort of like a foreshadowing of how that's going to work is you look at religion and what's happened to religion over the past 200, 300 years, and how it's accelerated in the age of the internet. And what it is that organizations like religions or governments or ideologies or, you know, all kinds of different organizations, prior to the information age, they had a lot of control over what information their members could get a hold yeah. of.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they had a lot of control over what their members thought. Not because their members were stupid, not because their members weren't trying to be well-informed, but because the information wasn't available to
yeah.
them.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, once you start having wide broadcasts of people saying, hey, this doesn't make any sense, and here are the reasons why, you look at the drop-off in religious participation, and you look at the increase in not just scandals, but scandals that get wide attention, like the pedophile priest scandal that, mm-hmm. like the Larry Nassar scandal and lots of other things like that that are going on. As we have more transparency, we have more ability of the demos, the population, the people, to look at what's going on, process what's going on, and have a reaction to that that's not just based on the information that the leaders provided, but right. it's based on information that they're getting from people who had the experience and from other people who have researched what's going on. And that creates an entirely different informational landscape that we're living in. We're just learning how that works and how to engage with that in productive ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's really important that as we move forward as a society, now that we're in a place, especially since 2016, where women are speaking up, we've had the Me Too movement, mm-hmm. You know, feminism is just like this hot topic issue that won't go away. Well, it hasn't gone away. Despite people's efforts to make mm-hmm. it go away. I think that it's interesting that now we are going to be seeing groups of young women where when these events happen, they are not going to be silent. They're not going to be silenced.
Right.
And that there's going to be repercussions sure. for upholding these institutions of rape culture, of misogyny, yeah. and in Luana K. Simon's case of this internalized misogyny, that mm-hmm. she would have rather had these her students, her mm-hmm. students and these young girls suffer than to have to admit that something was rotten in the state of Denmark,
yeah.
to admit it and to possibly, you know, get in trouble for it. And if she had just come out and said, you know, we've got to get rid of him. There were people who had come forward to say mm-hmm. that it had been happening, and they swept it under the rug. If she hadn't have just swept it under the rug and taken care of it, she would not have been in as much trouble as she is now. She's got two felonies, mm-hmm. you know, that she's staring down right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's well-deserved because she didn't do the right thing.
Yeah.
And it's good. It's a warning to everyone else. You have to do the right thing right. in these cases.
Well, so a couple of things about that. One is, first of all, I want to say that, yes, you're going to have a lot more women coming out and speaking up when these things happen. But let's not forget that that's still going, that that is still in our culture a very difficult and dangerous thing to do. And mm-hmm. we need to make sure to support women who do that. The other thing that I want to point out about what you said about Luann Simon and her willingness to kowtow to the patriarchy. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is a piece of authoritarianism. Authoritarianism isn't just when you have somebody who stands up and says, you know, I am the dictator or something like that, like Trump clearly wants to, it's about, an internalized culture of deference to authority.
Yeah.
Okay. And one of the things about that that I want to point out is that it's not just about, individual people saying, hey, everybody should be an individual and all of that, which is what the right wants you to think that they're about.
Right.
But what it's actually about on the right, and especially the far right, like we're seeing rising in Europe a lot right now, and we're seeing a lot more of today. And I know that you had Jeremy, you had something you wanted to talk about there, but I want to make this point. It's about what the right is about. On the far, especially on the far right, is about this hierarchical top-down authoritarianism. And it's not just that they want to be top-down to other people, it's that they accept being on the bottom of that to their leader. They accept that Trump, for example, is going to lie to them. Mexico is going to pay for the wall.
Right.
Okay.
Let's start to go find me.
I haven't seen his supporters rise up and say, hey, you told us Mexico was going to pay for the wall. They're saying, all right, well, so in other words, what they're saying is that they're willing to be beaten down. They're willing to have their pockets robbed by a man who came along and said, give me your vote and I'll make sure somebody else pays for it. But then rather than being willing to stand up and say, you know what? He didn't follow through on his promise.
Right.
He's trying to pick my pocket for this, and now he's trying to pick a fight with people who won a majority, you know, by 9 million votes, I think it was. Seven to 9 million, I can't remember right now. I think one of the numbers was from earlier before they had more of the votes counted. But, you know, so this willingness of people on the right, especially the far right, to be subservient. Mm-hmm. Because that's what they are. They're subservient. When you talk about Nazis, when you talk about the alt-right, when you talk about these people, these are subservient beta males. And they'll talk about it in those terms, so I'm going to use their language. These are subservient beta males who are looking for somebody's boots to lick. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean, and unfortunately, that means that what they're doing is they're also have an awful lot of rage when people won't turn around and lick their boots when they think that they're the ones that are supposed to be in authority.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is, in a democracy, you don't get to have that authority.
No. Mm-hmm.
So, but talk to us about what you've been seeing in Europe. You've been paying a lot of attention to that, Jeremy.
So, as we know, in Poland. In the 1940s, 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust. And after the Holocaust, Poland and much of Eastern and Central Europe were occupied by the Soviet Union or communist socialist buffer states to the Soviet.
So wait a minute. Let's just be clear. Yeah. None of those states were communist or socialist.
But not in the sense that we would. They were. Yeah.
the idea that they were communist or socialist is propaganda that was started by started by Stalin. After Lenin had called, for example, Lenin was absolutely right when he said that the Soviet Union is state capitalism. Mm-hmm. Okay, because the I'm sorry to interrupt you, that's a really important point
going on right now.
We'll come back to that. So you had the diaspora of the surrounding states around the Soviet Union.
Yes, around the Soviet Union. That so Poland is occupied by the Soviet and. This movement called Solidarność, which was a trade union movement that was sponsored by the Americans, by the CIA, as well as the Vatican, to take down Soviet influence and power in Poland and in Eastern Europe, which ended up causing this fall of the Soviet state in the Baltics, which led to the fall of the Soviet Union completely. So with all this having happened, the organization of Solidarity that started this union that took the place of the government had fractioned into two groups. And there's one that was sort of, liberal democracy that in a very, European sense. And within that group was a far right movement that was very strongly identified with being ethnically Polish, discriminating against Ukrainians, Belarusians, Roma, Jewish people living in Poland, and really identified strongly with the Roman Catholic Church as a part of their identity. So this group has grown since the 1980s and 90s, and has now, this organization, the acronym is PIS, P-I-S, aptly, has now sort of taken power, or given, power to these very fragile ethnocentrists in Poland who are pretending that they're trying to rewrite history, basically, and saying that that Soviet occupation was as bad, was the worst atrocity to happen in Poland, worse than the Holocaust, worse than what happened when Germany had control over Poland. And it's this is causing this sort of vacuum of this, resurgence of anti-Semitism again in Poland. And there are these new neo-Nazi uprisings there. Mm-hmm. And this isn't just in Poland either, because the same thing is going on in Hungary.
Yeah.
And the same shit is going on in Italy. The Italian, the Italians have a similar group called, I can't think of the name, Lega. And this organization had taken power. The leaders were elected in June of 2017. And the minister there wants to number the Roma people that live there in
Italy.
Number
them as in
have a registry of the Roma people, and then kick poor people out of housing that they may be squatting in, because private property is sacred is one of the
right.
sort of phrases that this new Italian government
using. Not human life is sacred.
Right.
Not people's lives are sacred.
But private property.
But private property is more sacred than people's lives and their right to to have a decent standard of living.
So since Italy is just north of Africa, many of the immigrant population comes from northern Africa.
Sure.
And have been the backbone of Italy for a really long time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this new government, I think Matteo Salvini, announced that, in quotations, the party's over for the immigrant. And so he has been threatening to deport a lot of these immigrants from Africa. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what, that's what is going on right now in Europe. Mm-hmm. But these ideas are international, because we are seeing the same damn shit with, the Steve Bannons and the Trumpers and the alt-right and Charlottesville and all these things. It's this new, weird, toxic fascist uprising. I don't know. That's my tangent. I mean, anyone interject and get there.
I know in Hungary, it's always been very bad. In the 40s, they had the Aerocross Party, which was the very Catholic, very nationalistic, basically Nazi party in Hungary, that aided the Germans, and they pandered to the Nazis and willingly gave up. And I can't remember the exact number, just thousands, this astounding number of its Jewish population. And, the Jewish population was very vital and important to Hungary. They were a huge population in the Budapest area, gave them all up, and to the Nazis, and this was the Aerocross party, and this was this just, there was a resurgence of this far right party, and they aided it, and now you see it under a new name in Hungary as the Jobbik party. And the Jobbik party is, if I'm not mistaken, and this might be incorrect, but they have a majority politically in Hungary, and it's the Aerocross party, and they're militant, and they have these small factions, like basically a la the Michigan militia, where they go to the border, or they go to these villages with large Roma populations, and if they aren't murdering, which isn't making the news headlines, there is that violent intimidation to get them to leave. And it's for no other reason. There might be propaganda saying that there's legitimate reasons, and it's always this property over humanity.
Right.
No other reason but just keeping the Hungarian state homogenized.
Right, right.
And they want to keep it.
Right.
They want to keep it white.
Right.
They want
Hungarian.
To keep Hungarian.
Catholic.
Yep.
Yeah.
And heterosexual. Yeah. I mean, they
right.
do it.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, because there are laws now. I don't know how long these laws have been in place in Hungary, but I mean, it is illegal for gays and lesbians to show affection to each other, and they could be thrown in jail for up to 3 years if somebody reports them. So
it's really amazing how fragile these supposedly tough guys are, that they can't handle the fact that there are people that love differently than they do, you know, or that think differently than they do, or that and that people that are different from them have an equal right to
the same
to life, liberty, happiness, and you know what, and you know, a decent standard of living. It's just, I think these are the lines that we're dealing with across the world about whether or not we're going to move farther into the realm of democratic decision making, where we insist on educated populations that have the time, resources, to engage in their own governments to ensure that the collective resources that the government is empowered to use are being used in a way that is good for that is towards the common good and the public interest, and not just towards the special good and the private interest of these people who are perfectly willing to kowtow to strongmen because they're subservient. Betas who are aggrieved that nobody is giving them the attention that they think they deserve. Now, Grant, now let me say, a lot of these people are from poor and otherwise marginalized communities, often rural communities, but not always. And I can understand some of their confusion when they feel like, hey, I'm not doing well, but you're telling me it's my fault because I have privilege and all of that. I understand that, okay? But the fact of the matter is that sometimes there are truths that are hard to hear. And if you're a real man, if you're a real, and I'm saying that to them. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that to them. I don't
to speak
mean
their language.
To speak
basically.
Their language. Yeah. If you want to be a real man, you stand up and deal with the real issues. And the real issue isn't a border wall. The real issue isn't immigrants.
Right.
The real issue is the small number of people who have convinced you to lick their boots rather than stand up for yourself and work with other people in your community and in surrounding communities to solve the problems that we all have. What they'd rather do is they'd rather tell you to lick their boots and be afraid of that guy and go and hurt those other people. And so we have to talk about how to organize the left in a way that's different from the way that they're organizing, because their way of organizing is licking the strongman's boots. And the left's way of organizing is, we don't have strong men. We have strong people, and we have strong networks, and we have the capacity to draw people up you know, draw people up from everywhere and come out and be a force by being together in our thousands and millions.
Yeah.
And to be able to do that effectively, to have that kind of organizing, that was that's been done before, in much smaller scale. Okay. You know, like you try in the early part of the U.S., in the early part of U.S. history, you had, for example, you had like renters revolts, where you had people that were, that had said, hey, you sound your horn. We're all going to come and help you, beat off the tax collector, for example, mm-hmm. or the rent collector.
And that happened in the 80s as well, when we had the big farming crisis, when mm-hmm. they would seize property and land in the houses of these poor farmers who, when the economy took a downturn, couldn't afford to mm-hmm. pay the lenders, couldn't pay the banks, the entire community mm-hmm. banded together, and they mm-hmm. would go to the auctions mm-hmm. and they wouldn't bet any more than a penny. Mm-hmm. And when they'd buy the property, they'd give it right back to the mm-hmm. the farmer that it belonged to. Mm-hmm. It's how do we get back?
Right.
How do we get back right. to that? And I read an article recently. It was a little unrelated, but it had this very interesting it was enlightening, because it talked about the pogroms that used yeah. to happen and mm-hmm. it, all around Europe against the Jewish population. And it was that the Jews were very frequently, they were used as the buffer and the scapegoat, mm-hmm. where you could look at the poor agrarian communities in Spain and say, but look at the Jewish tax collectors who are in here, and look at how they're doing. They're not hungry. And this mm-hmm. isn't true. There were tons of impoverished Jews in Pale Settlement even.
Sure.
But they could say, look at how good they're doing. You know, the landowners and the actual wealthy Europeans and the Spaniards and the Portuguese. And mm-hmm. it would infuriate mm-hmm. the peasant class and mm-hmm. these very low class people. And they would attack the Jews. And it was because they would always attack that buffer, mm-hmm. but never the people who were actually responsible for the
right.
poverty.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They were the thing they could just throw it out and then run away, and they would be safe behind these fortress walls. Mm-hmm. And you see that now.
Yeah.
And it has, and that's, this isn't to say that anti-Semitism does not still exist, but it's to say that you see it now more with Islamophobia. Mm-hmm. The Greeks and the Italians and the Serbians, they're using the Muslim immigrants who are coming in to say, this is why our employment is so bad, mm-hmm. and it's so bad in Spain. It's 30%, 40% unemployment mm-hmm. for millennials, and it has to be the Libyans coming in. It has to be the Syrians coming in. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, there is still a caste system there. They have monarchs in these mm-hmm. countries,
oh, right.
and they're refusing to even tear down those fortress walls when they have this very viable scapegoat in these refugee camps, these vulnerable classes of people that they can get to. And it's, how do we get these people to see beyond the smoke and mirrors that, you know, this ruling class is put in front of you?
I mean, that I think that's one of the key challenges that we face is on the left is to get more people to see beyond the tribe.
Yeah.
And understand, not that there's any problem. I'm not at all in any way. I'm very much in favor of, in fact, family and community. But there's a difference between family and community and tribe. And the difference is that family and community are open mm-hmm. to others. Open to other family, open to other members of the community, and so on, as opposed to tribe, which is specifically closed to anybody that's not in the tribe.
Right.
And I don't even have a problem with people saying, hey, this is my group and that's your group. I don't even have a problem with that, so long as they don't then go and say, and my group gets to have special privileges that your group doesn't.
The supremacy over the equality.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. Right. But the way that we're brought up in our culture, we're brought up to think in very top-down ways. Like, for mm-hmm. example, you have people that get tongue-tied in front of a celebrity. Okay. Oh, yeah. You have people, whether that celebrity is somebody from Hollywood, or whether it's a politician that's famous,
right.
or whatever it is, sports star, et cetera. That comes from that, from that is partly driven by, you know, our culture of subservience to authority.
Yeah.
You learn it in schools. I don't know if you're aware, you know, who Horace Mann was, two N's on the end of that, mm-hmm. end of that, was one of the people mostly responsible, one of the people most responsible for, the public education system in the U.S. And, he went around in the 1800s asking industrialists, you know, trying to get support for the idea of public schools. And he had a number of arguments, but he, you know, one of them was about social cohesion. One of the things that schools is going to do is create more social cohesion because you get more interaction between people, in a common setting and with some common ideas, et cetera. But he went around and asked a lot of the industrialists and captains of industry of his day and said, what do you want that people should learn in school so that when they show up at your factory, because, you know, this was a transition period from where people would mostly, you know, learn skills and trades with tradesmen. You had a trade guild, you know, yeah. Type of situation to an industrial economy. And they said, we want people to show up on time, follow orders, be able to read so that we can give them written instructions, be able to write so that, you know, they can write reports, and great, it would be great if they can do some math. Mm-hmm. That would be cool. And so it starts out with show up on time.
Yeah.
Follow orders.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When we don't teach people, you know, in science, you're happy when you're wrong. Because you learned something.
Yeah.
Okay. If you have a hypothesis and it turns out you're right, yeah, you learned something too.
Sure.
That's great. But when you learn something, when you have a hypothesis and you go out and do the research and you find out that you're wrong, that gives you a whole new area of research. That's an exciting day to a scientist that's any good at doing mm-hmm. science. Okay. We find out, you know, but in school, you get penalized for being wrong.
Yeah.
Okay. And so this is the one, I think one of the greatest challenges that we have on the left going forward is, helping people to get out of that mode of, subservience to authority and deference to authority. Those are two different levels, but, and then this idea that being wrong is somehow bad.
Yeah. 100%.
What other challenges you see for the left going forward, you know, in the next year or further?
You know, I was just on the way here was talking a little bit to Ben about one of the problems that's been the big talking point on at least my neck of the woods on Twitter, and it was surrounding Louis Farrakhan and people in the women specifically who are leading the women's march and the ones who have been connected to him or who have seen him speak and have some sort of, you know, relation to him in that way. There is this infighting that's now occurring because of his remarks that he's made about the gay community and about the Jewish community. Mm-hmm. And these aren't like just average. It's not your average just homophobia, and it's not your average anti-Semitism. It is like, it's as bad as you can get, like,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, Farrakhan is way out there on those topics.
Very. And now there's a lot of infighting within the Jewish community, the Black community, and the Black Jewish community. Mm-hmm. We can't find this even footing where we can get to this one common spot where we can say, we can all agree that Louis Farrakhan did things that really helped the Black community, that really helped the Black Muslim community, while also acknowledging that he has said and done and ordered horrible things to happen in these communities, in his within his own community, and to denounce it, and to go moving forward to say, we are going to be, you know, we acknowledge what he's done. We denounce the bad he's done. And moving forward, we're going to find someone who has most of those good traits. Yeah, and we can keep evolving so that we can make up for it. There is no one who is willing to find that even footing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard because I think that there's a lot of people, and especially in the Jewish community, you find anti-Semitism. So a lot of leftist Jews are afraid to either say anything or to back down from anti-Semitism. Yeah. So moving forward, there has to be these like very, very deep, serious, but calm and you know, plentiful conversations where we can get to this understanding of who everyone is, what is wrong, and like you said, admitting wrong where wrong has been done.
Yeah.
Otherwise, this infighting is going to tear apart this really good movement. The Women's March is very important.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are things that need to get talked about, but until we can get this even footing, it is going to just keep crumbling, you know.
So one thing about that I really like, you know, looking at the structure of things so that we can look at the structure separate from the particular instance and look at how we react differently in different situations, even when the structure is the same. So, for example, this idea that somebody could do really good things for a community but also do really, really awful things. Okay, that's a problem that we have across U.S. history.
Yeah.
For example, you know, Thomas Jefferson owning slaves, having, you know, a sex slave, Sally Hemings. I mean, and you can argue, and I don't know how much agency she had in that, but in the culture, she didn't.
You know?
So I've heard people argue that, but I'm sorry, that's just in the cultural situation, that is just not the case.
Yeah.
So my point is that if we're going to talk about, Louis Farrakhan in that way, I think we also need to acknowledge that we have a whole very powerful system in our country of education that teaches those things completely separately and very often ignores, the bad things that the white leaders of our country have done. Sometimes also the black leaders, because as I understand it, for example, Martin Luther King had a problem with how he related to women as well.
Yeah.
Let me just say, by the way, I feel uncomfortable as a white guy saying that in our culture. I don't think I should feel uncomfortable saying facts.
Right.
Okay. But I do. And that's part of the thing I was talking about earlier, about we have to be able to have a conversation where people aren't going to be attacked for getting something wrong. If I got the facts wrong, tell me I got the facts wrong. If you think that that's something that should be ignored, that these are facts that should be ignored because of other things that somebody did, I think that's an argument that isn't about race. I think that's an argument that's about how we handle inequality, and we ought to have that discussion openly and honestly.
Yeah.
And very often we don't, and partly because it's an uncomfortable conversation, and a lot of people aren't willing to have those kind of uncomfortable conversations.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the big challenges that we have, is having those kinds of conversations. But let's talk about what's hopeful, because we're coming up on the new year. And what are you guys looking forward to? What do you see on the horizon? What do you think we can be hopeful about?
Damn good question.
Yeah.
After we've just gone into all of that, I don't know.
Not right. Some days.
And we can go back to that. If I transition too fast out of that, I wasn't trying to run away from anything. Let's go for it.
Hopeful. Well, I mean, gotta be optimistic. We do have Gretchen Whitmer.
Yeah.
She wasn't my first choice for governor, but she sure is hell. After that primary was my first choice for governor.
I
am more than thrilled to have her.
Well, the choice is available.
Yes, of course. Sure. I'm more than happy to have her as my governor. Sure. I'm thrilled that Dana Nessel is also the new attorney general. Obviously, we've got Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She's, you know, she's in the White House. And now I'm blanking. So, like in Congress, sorry.
In Congress, yeah.
Not near the White House.
Yeah. I wouldn't wish her in there. Well, she'd probably go toe to toe and do just fine. So
And
let me, by the way, let me say, I was a big critic of Pelosi prior to in the early stages of the thing about the speakership, because I didn't think that she was going to be able to have she didn't have what it took to stand up to Trump in public, because that's a particular skill set, and I had not seen that from her. Maybe I dismissed it, but the things that have happened the last several weeks, I was wrong about that. She did a really great job at the meeting in the Oval Office, and you know, that was great. all of the other criticism, you know, there's lots of problems that we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. But you know what? When I'm wrong, I'm wrong. She did a great job with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's exciting to have had this blue wave. But now it's, I think, our duty to also hold these Democrats accountable for what we want and to hold their feet to the flames if they aren't doing what we want them to do, if they're not doing what we elected them to do. I mean, but yeah, I'm optimistic. I'm more optimistic than not, I would say. I'm still a little pessimistic, but I'm more optimistic in this coming year that we are closer to the end of Trump's first term.
Hopefully only.
And I think that if we bring more awareness to what's going on to the average person who may not really pay attention to the news and tell them these are things that are happening, these things are going to affect you, maybe we can make more positive change.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I am really hopeful about the number of people who talk about we got to hold the Democrats' feet to the fire. Because that used to be a thing that I had a hard time getting people to be interested in for a long time. That's a new thing that I think we really have that we can really have some hope about in terms of what we're going to be able to do in changing the conversation. Because it's one thing to have an election cycle where you go and you get a lot of Democrats elected. Well, you know, there are different spectrums of the you know, there's a spectrum across the Democratic Party.
For sure.
And some of them are very, very corporatists and very, very authoritarian, even if they couch it in relatively friendly language. And I think that holding the Democrats' feet to the fire is an important project where we can work on the organization that we need to work on for the left, to be able to organize in ways that are not top down, and in large part to get people thinking about how to behave in a culture where you're not indoctrinated into this deference to authority. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people listening are going, I don't have deference to authority. But here's the thing is that how many people, just think about this, how many people, especially, you know, talking to people on the left right now, how many of you have been in a meeting, you know, where you're, you know, an organizing meeting, and you have something to say, but you know, you're not quite sure if it's really good enough, or you're not quite sure if it's exactly germane, or you're not, but there's somebody up there in front that's talking, and so you just don't. Okay? There's a lot of that that goes on. There's a lot of that that goes on all over, not just on the left, but everywhere across the culture, because that's what our culture teaches us to do, is to have deference to the teacher who's at the front of the room talking, for example. Have deference to the politician who's on the big screen telling us what's going on, supposedly. Have deference to, you know, there's all of these different places where we're taught to have deference and we're taught to be quiet and sit down. We're being rude to somebody, or, you know, or when we're speaking truth to power, we're told we're being rude. No. Yeah. Anybody who's in power in a democracy works for us and has to listen to us.
Yes.
And we need to get that into our bellies in a way that we don't have right now, as far as I see across the culture. Some people have it. We need more people to have it, and we need more people to have it more regularly. But that also means that we need to have ways of organizing with people who are going to be opinionated, who are going to have strong ideas, and we're going to have to work out ways to do that together and be effective. And those are not simple things. Those are not things that we have strongly developed in the course of history so far. There are ideas out there. There's some good books. There's a good book, I'm just getting into it now, called This Is an Uprising. Look it up on the internet. I can't think of the name of the author right now. But he talks about, by the way, how people organized in Poland, for example, to overturn the government there, and the ways that and other areas as well. Talks about a lot of different incidents like that. So I'm sorry. That's just we talked about. I said, you know, to have hope, but I really do have hope that we have some good stuff to work with here to move forward.
Yeah, and all these like really self-aware, very powerful, just like raised right on the cusp of the media doing this like girl power, this black girl magic. These Gen Z kids, they're growing up and they're going to be the next wave of voters. And I'm very optimistic, not only for next year, within their own, like, you know, what is it, like the off season, mm-hmm. what is it, off season elections and stuff like that, but mm-hmm. to see them moving forward, especially in 2020, with their voices, because right. their voices are already heard, and these right. are like 16, 17 year old kids. Right. I am so excited to see these kids move mm-hmm. forward and really change right. the face of America, oh, yeah. where millennials yeah. have been, and that's, this isn't to shame like Gen Xers, but we have felt very unaided. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As a group of kids, we've been, you know, only just talked down upon for being raised by Gen Xers. Mm-hmm. they weren't happy enough with how they raised us. So instead of being introspective, they just got mad at us. But millennials and these Gen Z kids, I think that we're at a point now where we're like, y'all, we could do it. Yeah, we could be the ones. Yeah. I'm optimistic as fuck for that. Yeah. I mean, honestly, yeah. I'm excited. Oh, yeah. I'm excited. I'm stoked.
So, yeah. so I have to say something here about that is that you're talking about 16, 17 year olds. I want to point out to people something very different about Michigan in terms of politics and 16, 17 year olds is that, you know, until you're 18, obviously you can't vote in a public election, mm-hmm. but you can join the Michigan Democratic Party. Can't join the Michigan Republican. Well, you can't. You might be able to join the Michigan Republican Party, but you don't get a vote. In the Republican Party, you have to be elected as a precinct delegate, which you can't run for until you're 18, in order to get a vote in that party. But in the Democratic Party in Michigan, if you're a resident of Michigan, you're 16 years old or older, you have the right to join the party, and it's not like some youth membership or something like that. Right. It is the full deal. You get the same rights as anybody else. The only thing that you can't do is there are some things that the party runs under direction from the state, believe it or not, some certain nominations. You can't vote in some of those. But in terms of, like, for example, we're having the chair of the Michigan Democratic Party is going to be elected at the spring convention February 2nd. If you're 16, 17 years old, you can sign up for the, you can join the MDP for free online before January 3rd. You can come to Cobo and vote. You can decide who's going to lead the party. Okay. Mm-hmm. And not just that leadership, but leadership across the party, party platform, party rules and structure, all of that, you get a full, you get an equal vote with everybody else. And that is literally the fact that the Democratic Party works that way in Michigan, where you just have to be a member in order to have the same rights as everybody else. That's what my favorite thing about the Democratic Party in this state. And we should advertise that more. We need to get more people involved, absolutely. More young people involved.
We all got young cousins and stuff,
right?
Yeah. And they have friends.
You know, and as much as I criticize the Democratic Party, I don't. You know, people. You know, the fact of the matter is that kind of openness is really critical to building what we have in the future, both outside of the party. You know, and inside, it's a force in our culture, and we should take account of it. Is all I'm saying.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay. Anything else before we wrap up, folks? Want to talk about?
No. I hope in the new year we hear about more Nazis being punched.
Right, there we go.
I'm hoping in the next year I've gotten my fair share in the next, next 3 days.
Right.
I talk to everyone next. So my knuckles are a little bruised. Right.
Sure.
it's interesting. That's actually, you know, whether or not to punch a Nazi at this juncture in our current situation, that's actually a more difficult problem than some people give it credit for. the reason is that we're talking about this organization. I'm not opposed to punching Nazis as a general rule. What I'm saying is that there are one of the ways that authoritarians work is that violence from below is never accepted. Violence from above to below is always justified.
Right.
So we have to be cognizant of how of how we're perceived. Because if we end up being perceived as the folks who are out there creating violence, okay,
right.
We either have to first, we either have to be very, very strong collectively that, we're going to be against violence, and we're going to be against violence however it's perpetrated, but we're not going to say that we're going to refrain from violence when that's the choice that's given, that's available.
And sometimes that may mean
in certain arguments that it's that you go out and punch a Nazi, and I'm totally down for that. But I'm not sure that having a big violent confrontation on the streets of Illinois, much as I hate Illinois Nazis, is the most effective way to move that needle, because we have other effective ways to do that, and we need to make sure that we use that we use stuff like that where it's appropriate and not where it's going to be detrimental. There's actually Ayman Kafaji, who's a good friend of mine, is the vice chair of the Progressive Caucus, wrote a good thing about, will a leftist or a progressive punch a Nazi, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good read. I'll see if I can find the link to it and put it in the description to the video.
Awesome.
I mean, to the audio here. Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff.
Yes.
How you doing, Jeremy?
Good. I'm all right. Yeah.
We're doing good.
Yes,
we're doing
yes. Good.
That's all for this episode. State of the Revolution is a production of Michigan Progressive. Our director and editor is Benjamin Klein. Our producers are Sam Pernick and Mara Zumberg. Our music is composed by Benjamin Klein. I'm Liano Sharon. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with another episode next week.